Welcome to a podcast from the Consensus Building Institute. CBI helps groups and organizations around the world negotiate and collaborate more effectively. It is headquartered in Cambridge, Massachusetts, and is online at cbuilding.org.
Hi, my name is Noah Susskind. For this episode of CBI Podcast, I'll be speaking with CBI Managing Director David Fairman. David, thanks for joining me.
My pleasure, Noah.
David, in a recent article you wrote for CBI Reports, which is also on the CBI website, you said that in order to be successful, political leaders need to do consensus building. This runs counter to the common idea that leadership, especially political leadership, is as much about persuading as it is about consensus building.
There is no question that political leadership is multifaceted and that persuasion and advocacy are big parts of it. When we look at governing in a democracy, though, what we realize very quickly is that no political actor, even a president, can make a major decision unilaterally. Political leaders need the support of others to make public policy and to implement it effectively. It's in that context that consensus building, defined broadly as bringing stakeholders together around a priority to move it forward, is critical for leadership.
And what do they need to be able to do that?
We talk about four sets of skills that political leaders need to be effective. Translating a political vision into a clear set of policy priorities is one. Assessing stakeholders, really understanding who they need to be able to move forward and what the interests of those stakeholders are is a second. Third is crafting a strategy that can effectively reach those stakeholders and address their interests and to some extent constrain their options in ways that move them toward agreement. And finally, the actual implementation, the execution of that strategy by political leaders, which involves to a great extent actually talking to people face to face, negotiating with them, and sometimes using your allies to do things for you when you are actually not the best conveyor of your own interests.
You mentioned translating a vision into priorities. Can you give examples of more and less effective priority settings? I mean, how can leaders pick the right ones?
Yes, it's a good question, and it's sort of like asking how Warren Buffett ends up picking the right stocks. If every political leader could unerringly get the priorities right, we'd have a whole lot more social progress than we do, and it's hard for good reason. We talk about three things that have to come together for a broader vision to translate into something concrete. There has to be a well enough defined public problem for there to be meaningful political and public action on it. So take the issue of climate change 20 years ago, 1988. There was a lot about the problem itself that wasn't clear, and there was a lot of uncertainty, not just about what to do, but about whether there was enough of a problem to do anything about. 20 years later today, there's much more consensus about the nature of the problem, and that then starts to make action look reasonable. The second thing is that there have to be some policy options that could be effective in dealing with the problem as it's been framed. And there again, that's both an analytic question and a question of developing ideas, but it's also a question about what's politically viable. The third thing that needs to be there then is the potential of a winning coalition or a broad public majority that could support a package of policy options to deal with the problem.
Okay. You mentioned assessing stakeholders. How do you do that?
Understanding in depth what stakeholders want on an issue can sometimes take quite a lot of work. Take the issue of ex-offenders, people coming out of prison or jail and trying to reintegrate into their communities and not commit crimes. The law enforcement and corrections and criminal justice and social service communities all want that to happen. Once you start to get into the details, though, of how to make it happen, one of the first things that you start to come up against is that they all have a legitimate concern that while they're trying to help people reintegrate more effectively, some proportion of those people may actually go ahead and commit another crime. And their efforts to help people get on track by being more flexible about the transition from detention to freedom may land them in political hot water. So understanding the difference between a substantive interest and a political risk, where people may need some cover to be able to do things that are in the public interest without jeopardizing their agency's reputation or image, can be a critical part of understanding their interests. And people may not be very frank in sharing those concerns, and it may take considerable work, dialogue, and exploration before you can really understand their core concerns.
You also talk about the interpersonal skills that leaders need to be effective. I mean, in a sense, aren't you telling Michael Jordan how to shoot free throws here? Don't they already have these skills? And isn't that part of what brought them to their position of leadership already?
In many cases, absolutely. And I think anyone who is not a political leader should have a good deal of humility in offering any advice on how to handle the interpersonal dimension to people who've been in some of the most challenging situations in the world. Having said that, we have plenty of examples of people in very senior positions who stumble badly in trying to manage conversation and achieve agreements because of some limitations in their own ability to connect and to show flexibility and to show creativity. Take Woodrow Wilson, who in many ways was an extraordinary president as a moral leader. He had a very strong moral vision for the country, both in peace and in war. He had a vision of the way the world could be after World War I. What tripped him up, though, in very serious ways, time and again, was his inability to work creatively or even flexibly with people who didn't fully share his moral view of the world. He was not only inflexible, he was sometimes downright intolerant of people who couldn't fully share his vision. And the result was that some of the most important goals that he was trying to achieve didn't get achieved because he couldn't build a coalition that was broad enough to move forward. He tried to get the U.S. Senate and the American people to back the League of Nations after World War I to try and put in place an architecture for international peace to prevent another war from happening. Sadly, because he was unwilling to compromise on any aspects of his proposal for a League of Nations, it ultimately failed in the Senate, where a number of conservatives had real concerns about unduly constraining America's options in international politics. More recently, I think you could look at any number of political leaders, but just for the sake of discussion, we could take Jimmy Carter and national energy policy in the late 1970s. He was very visionary in recognizing a long-term problem facing America. And it was the combination of energy security and diversification of energy supply that he wanted to get at. And he had arguably a good political moment because of the rise in oil prices and the increasing instability of supply in the Middle East after the revolution in Iran. But he didn't go about his policy strategy as a consensus-building exercise. He knew he was right. He went on national television. He told the American people that we needed to conserve. And he told the nation that we had in our energy policy the moral equivalent of war. What he didn't do was bring on board the very wide range of constituencies with a direct interest in national energy policy and try to build a consensus on change. Instead, he had an expert group issue a report about where the nation should be in the year 2000 on energy policy. And frankly, that report had no political support because it didn't really have any participation in its process beyond a narrow group of experts. So right idea at the right time, arguably, but failed the test of consensus building and so went nowhere fast.
That's a good example. Are there examples of leaders that were able to use these skills effectively?
There absolutely are. One of the most notable, I mentioned in the article, is Abraham Lincoln, who had a reputation as being kind of a country bumpkin and a rube and was constantly made fun of by the East Coast establishment and the press in his campaign for president and then in his early years in the White House. What he demonstrated over time was an extraordinary ability to work with a very wide range of people with very differing views on the core issues of war and emancipation and to create during the war a series of principled agreements on how to handle some of the most complex issues like treatment of freed slaves that demonstrated his ability to stay with his own principles, to meet the interests of others, to demonstrate to them authenticity and sincerity, and to build their trust in him, and by doing that, to build his own political capital to make even harder decisions later.
Can you give an example of that?
What Abraham Lincoln did as a president that was so different from what he did as a campaigner was to take his principled position, which people debate, but which seems to have been fairly unvarying toward the end of slavery, and make very wise trade-offs about the pace and timing and the nature of the incremental steps that could be made. So, for example, during the war, he ordered that freed slaves be able to maintain their freedom across Union lines. At the same time, he ordered his troops and their generals not to make special efforts to achieve freedom for the slaves, but to focus on their military objectives as the first priority. And in so doing, he angered some abolitionists who felt that the Union should be fighting primarily to free the slaves. But at the time, he recognized that the best incremental move forward was to focus on the war objectives and to treat the problem of freed slaves and of freeing slaves as secondary. And that was successful.
I want to ask you about a couple of things that strike me as unique to leaders is that they, as consensus builders, might want to remain neutral as a neutral third party, but they're also expected to advocate on behalf of certain groups, either groups within their constituency or to other groups that their constituency is maybe negotiating with. What can you say to that for, I mean, what leaders can do?
There is no political leader who is truly neutral and impartial, both on a personal level because of the convictions they bring and as a political matter because, except in totalitarian states, nobody's elected by 100%. And there are meaningful policy differences and political differences that separate leaders from some portion of the population and key constituencies. Having said that, I think that the most effective political leaders are able to balance and to choose the right role at the right moment. Take the example of John Kennedy during the Cuban Missile Crisis. There was a powerful internal debate within the small group of advisors that he convened when they first learned that the Soviet Union had placed missiles in Cuba. In that internal debate, JFK chose to play a more neutral and facilitative role. He asked many questions of the XCOM, that group, but didn't, for a long time, put out his own views on what was the right solution. And he did that not only because he wasn't sure, but also because he needed that group to come together in near unanimity in order to be confident in moving forward with a strategy. Once that group had come together in a near consensus for the strategy of a quarantine of Cuba, then the president switched into more of an advocacy mode, both with the American people and with the Soviet Union. When he did that, there were some constituencies within the U.S., those who wanted a more military response right away, and those who wanted a more negotiated response right away, who weren't fully on board, but he knew that he had captured the center of the debate. And similarly, with the Soviet Union, he knew that he had crafted a strategy that in the international community would likely rally the center. And so, above all, when a president is effective, he's effective by taking a ground that represents a reasonable point of view and a position, but one that's going to secure the broad center and hold it.
It seems to me that senior leaders like presidents, governors, mayors, council members, and legislators are, I mean, wouldn't they be kind of hesitant to broadcast the fact that they're becoming consensus builders? Either because they don't want to look like they're coercing people or because, I mean, to a lot of people, being a leader means being powerful and exercising judgment. Why is it in their interest to use consensus building instead?
That's a great question, and it doesn't have an easy answer. It's not always the case that it is in the interest of senior leaders to be consensus builders. Sometimes the best thing they can do is fight a good fight, a fight that actually brings a majority to their side and brings a majority that's more passionate because it's a fight. More and more, though, the sheer complexity of the issues that we face as a democracy, from local land use planning to climate change, require even the most principled and combative leaders to find allies and craft solutions that will win broad majorities. And doing that requires a different form of leadership and a different vision of leadership than maybe has traditionally been the case. I think the other thing I would say is that you can claim credit as a consensus builder as much as you can when you act as an advocate. It's a different kind of credit, but it's very powerful in many communities for a leader to be recognized by a remarkably broad array of stakeholders, not just the usual suspects, not just the people who you would expect would support or vote for that leader, but some people who may actually have been on the other side on a number of issues to say, in this case, that leader played a critical role in bringing us together. That can be a powerful political statement of its own.
If I'm a leader hearing this for the first time, hearing about this for the first time, and I hear you talking about trade-offs and compromise, I'm going to maybe be reluctant to learn how to get 50% of what I want, if that's what I think compromise is. So can you just briefly explain the difference between compromise and consensus?
Absolutely. As you say, in a compromise, we both start with our aspirations, the things that we want to achieve, and we decide after listening to each other and seeing whether we can nudge each other closer to our preferred outcomes, that the best thing to do is split the difference. And so we do. For example, on automobile fuel efficiency standards, environmental advocates say we ought to be at 40 miles a gallon by the year 2020. And the car manufacturers say, honestly, anything more than 30 is going to be economically ruinous for us. So the Congress mulls this over and comes out with 33.5 as the outcome. The question that went unanswered was, well, what would be the combination of investments by government, the auto manufacturers, the university community, and others that could actually dramatically increase the likelihood of a breakthrough in automotive technology that would leapfrog us well beyond where we are now? That's the consensus building that we strive for by including the diversity of stakeholders that's necessary to be as creative as possible while meeting the broadest range of interests, and by helping them frame a conversation in terms of questions that go beyond what can you live with toward what is the shared vision toward which we could all work and how could we best achieve it given our interests and the constraints that we face. That's what we try to do. And when it works well, we get outcomes that are well beyond the lowest common denominator. Hmm. But just to give one more example that's a concrete success in consensus building, look at the way that stakeholders came together on clean air amendments in 1990, when industry was very concerned about the costs of increasing the standards for environmental safety of emissions from power plants. Environmentalists were very concerned that maintaining the status quo would be harming health and the environment to an intolerable degree. Rather than simply battling over what the standard should be, they came up with a very creative solution, which was tradable permits for sulfur dioxide emissions that enabled those utilities that were very efficient in their ability to reduce emissions to be net winners, and those that were less efficient to lose less than they otherwise would have by being able to buy permits to emit. And it's that kind of creativity that we look for and try to encourage by driving at the core question, what are your interests, rather than simply taking positions on what number the standard should be.
That's David Fairman, Managing Director of the Consensus Building Institute. I'm Noah Susskind. Dave, thanks for joining me.
My pleasure, Noah. Thank you.
This has been a podcast from the Consensus Building Institute. You can find us online at www.cbuilding.org.
And this track is called Ladies Younger by Dewey DeLay.